Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Brian Thurston, a good friend of mine. He is truly an environmental entrepreneur. We're going to track his path of travel, a colorful career. It ain't over yet. Happy to have Brian on the show today. Hey, Brian, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ted.
Good to see you. So let's talk. I've already introduced you as an environmental entrepreneur, which I think is maybe who you really are. But let's talk a little bit about you and sort of figure out what makes Brian Thurston tick. Born and raised, you are a SoCal beach surfer dude, right?
Correct. Yeah, I was born in Torrance, California, but raised and grew up, you know, and still live in the South Bay. I grew up in a town called Manhattan Beach, and I now live in a town called Hermosa Beach, which is right next to it. My parents are neither one of them are California natives. My dad came from New Jersey in the 60s, brought out west by a job, and my mom also came to California in the 60s, but she came from Sweden. So I guess first generation California, but lived here other than a couple stints with work and school, lived here my whole life.
And I grew up in an apartment building in New York City, and so I can't imagine growing up and being a being surfing. But you had that life, right? I mean, surfing was and still is, and we'll talk more about your board position at Sustainable Surf. But surfing and the beach has been a big part of your life, right? Fair to say?
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, it's probably a big inspiration as to how I ended up in the field that you and I both work in. I grew up on the beach my whole life, surrounded by sports, surfing, bodyboarding, body surfing, swimming. I lived in the ocean, all throughout the year, in the summertime, especially, when we were small kids. But then as I got into surfing in the wintertime too, get up at 5 a.m. and ride my bike down to the beach and go surfing before school starts at 8, that kind of thing. And that lasted all the way through high school. Until I started taking, some sports a little bit more serious, and the surfing kind of fell off by the wayside and became more of a hobby. I don't surf as much as I'd like to anymore, but yeah, I've maintained it throughout my whole life.
And were you aware that the ocean, the water quality was deteriorating?
Yeah. I mean, there's really great organizations in Southern California, like Heal the Bay and others, that do constant water quality monitoring, but it was, probably the most kind of prescient or front of mind thing that was really in front of your face was trash, right? So, when we were kids, we would always do beach cleanups, take 10 pieces of trash off the beach every day was sort of a mantra, that kind of thing. And so you became, sort of eco-conscious as a kid, not really because of any kind of political stance or anything like that. It was just sort of like, hey, this is our beach and we want to keep it clean. And there would be times of the year when certain tides or, the one thing that people don't realize is Manhattan Beach is literally adjacent to one of the largest oil refineries on the West Coast, the Chevron oil refinery. And so every once in a while you get some sort of residual tar or some pollution or things like that, and they would close the beach. And that was always a very dramatic event, Yeah. So it sort of resonated with you. And so, you started following and supporting groups like the Surf Rider Foundation. And like I mentioned before, Heal the Bay and things like that, even as a young kid, they would, oh, we're hosting a beach cleanup in Manhattan Beach. And so everyone would go down there and you kind of help it, lend a helping hand. So it just became kind of ingrained in the ethos of growing up here.
Yeah, that's really nice. And then off to college and at USC, University of Southern California, and you were studying American literature. So you had in mind that you were going to be a writer or a screenwriter. What was the plan?
It's interesting because I was always interested in literature. English was probably one of my favorite classes, even in high school. Being a writer, had sort of an allure to it, once I stopped playing competitive sports, I actually went to Long Beach State first. I was recruited to play volleyball at Long Beach State, and I only lasted one semester there. Mm-hmm. And I realized quickly that, going to that next level in athletics is really the, it be, is where it becomes more of a job than more of a, you know, a pastime, you know? Yeah. And there was, you know, I realized that the camaraderie that I had with all my buddies, you know, in high school was as much as how much of I love the sport. So I decided to transfer, and that's when I transferred to USC, and I wanted to study film and literature and become a writer. Yeah. So that was sort of the crazy undergrad days.
Yeah. And then I think you described to me the other day that there was a gap between your undergrad and your grad school experience where you were off doing event planning in the film industry, and you were really sort of immersed in that whole sector.
Yeah. I mean, just sort of bouncing around, you know, like just trying to learn how it operated, you know, working as a production assistant and then working in mailrooms and working as a temp, you know, in different studios and things like that. And then I fell into sort of the event space because that everything was sort of temporary, right? And so a friend of mine had an event company that I would work for a few months a year, and that got into some larger events and action sports. So I was sort of working at surf contests and skateboard competitions and snowboarding competitions and things like that. And I was just kind of cobbling together a living, and did that for the greater part of, 8 or 9 years, you know,
and then something, and then the light bulb went off.
Then the light bulb went off. I realized it's really not sustainable, most likely, to keep doing that. And I really wanted to look into a career. And so that is when I started thinking about things like graduate school, law school, et cetera. And I really went through sort of an exercise of what I was really interested in and passionate about, and what I would basically tie, you know, a great portion, you know, of one's life, working life, you know, dedicating your time and energy to do something, you might as well do something that you're passionate about or worthwhile. And so I always gravitated towards the environmental sector. And so that's what I did. And so I decided to go to grad school and study environmental science, policy, and sustainability. And that's what sort of really launched me off into this career, which is going on 17 years ago.
Right. You went to Johns Hopkins, which is based in Baltimore, but you were in a DC program
So it was a sort of like a hybrid program where you could do part of the program on the DC campus. Hopkins on Massachusetts Ave, just off DuPont Circle, Hopkins has a bunch of buildings, and it's like the School of Advanced Environmental Studies. It's the business school. So if you're getting your MBA, you know, it's a lot of graduate programs. And so I was in one of those buildings on Mass Avenue, and
yeah,
I was there on and off for about 2 years.
And that's pretty different than SoCal living.
It is pretty different. Yes. Yes. You know, up to your eyeballs in policy and politics, and, you know, everyone is running and talking fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then I'm fast forwarding a little bit, but I met you when you worked for Ecomedia and our friend,
2007.
Paul Palazzotto, who had this interesting idea that he should get large companies that were spending a lot of money on advertising, and instead of doing conventional advertising and television and radio and billboards and all that, get them to invest in eco projects and get their name on it and get the same level of credit, if not more, for doing that. I was involved, or EcoMotion was involved, in a project in Miami the Miami City Hall. And then we were involved in Long Beach at the airport.
At the airport, yep.
And I know that all went down in flames after not that many months, or it was purchased by CBS. What was your role there, Brian?
So I was hired to be what was called at the time a program director. And that was sort of, you know, once the sponsorship and the project were married together, was to sort of help, you know, bring those projects along. And then also bring potentially new project ideas, you know, where some of the sponsor dollars could be distributed. And then also a little bit of business development, you know, sort of, you know, how can you bring on some of these new municipalities or new sponsors into some of these, really, they were kind of education and outreach projects when you break them down, you know, they were sort of like, okay, how can we do demonstration projects in high traffic areas to sort of educate the public, whether it was, you know, consumers or customers or travelers or whomever, right, in a public space. It was a really, really interesting model. And you're right. They CBS it transitioned into CBS and moved many of the operations to New York City. And I was obviously based on the West Coast. So I was off and running, thrown into all kinds of interesting consulting, opportunities and things like that. And I think that's kind of where the entrepreneurial piece or that entrepreneurial spirit, really kicked in. It was really out of necessity.
Yeah. Well, I know you did some work with the Los Angeles Community College District and Metro, yeah. But let's fast forward to waste management. Cause I want to get into a few case studies with you, but waste management sure. hired you on in 2011. And right. I remember hearing that you went to waste management. I thought, oh my God, Brian Thurston's going to waste management. Huge operation. I think I thought of it as being very conservative at the time, but tell me about how did you fit in there?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I heard about the role with a gal that I actually went to grad school with. She was working with WM at the time. And, I would have never even probably known about this position if it wasn't for her. So I have to thank her for that. And I have many times over the years. But it was a really interesting role. WM at the time and still does. I think it's gone through a few iterations in what it's called. But at the time, they had an organization within the larger sort of WM ecosystem called Sustainability Services. And so I was hired on to be a business development manager, sort of everything west of Texas. Originally, it was sort of geographical. Yeah. And that was really working with existing WM customers and new customers in all of their different segments of business, whether it's public sector, private sector, what have you, to look at how sustainability, innovation, through usually their lens of recycling or material management, but it started to grow a little bit beyond that into energy and other impact areas. But how they could sort of leverage the breadth and depth and the size, because you mentioned of WM, to create new solutions and better value propositions for their customers. And so this is sort of in the beginning of zero to landfill, zero waste, consulting, zero waste events, things like that. And so the consulting team at WM was really kind of at the forefront of stuff like that. Definitely within the large waste and recycling companies, there was, a lot of consulting going on and things like that in the private sector doing similar things, but no one really adopted it at that scale other than WM at the time. Now I think many of them are doing similar things.
It's interesting to think. I mean, I think of waste management as being a trash hauling company. I guess.
Yes, and they are the biggest one by far. The biggest
one in the country. But was this to create a new source of revenues, like the consulting division? Or was it to bring value to your biggest customers or both?
Yeah, I think I might butcher the history a little bit, but from what I remember and understand, it was kind of born out of a group that was working primarily with heavy industrial customers. And, when you're working at those types of sites, you might have 20, 30, 40 different waste streams, and many of which have value. So there's steels and plastics and, and all wood and all these kinds of things. So rather than landfill everything, corporate initiatives, even all the way back to 2011, we're pushing towards more sustainability. So it's sort of like, okay, let's take our industrial site, zero landfill, and then hopefully zero waste at some point. That's obviously a lot more complex, but so that was sort of the impetus behind it. And I think they really cornered the market for a little while, and then it became, industry standard, and they had a lot of competition. But it was a pretty dynamic team. It was a few hundred people at the time within an organization with upwards of 50,000 people. But a lot of revenue drove through that division. So it was relatively high profile. It was a really interesting role, within mm-hmm. a company that a lot of people have a very could have a very negative sort of opinion of, because right. At one side they have one of the largest private fleets of heavy duty trucks, but also conversely one of the largest renewable fuel fleets in the country, but they also the largest owner of landfills, right? And that landfills are what they are, so I think they were really at the forefront of trying to sort of make a difference at that world. And now many of them have come along. And you know, the company has performed incredibly well over the last 15 years, you know, so, you know, they're onto something.
But how great to think about, you know, you take the organization with such a huge footprint and you can make a really huge impact. It sounds, do you happen to know what the diversion rate sort of went from, or, you know, what the percentage of solid waste now that is diverted by waste management? Was that a metric that was common or commonly used, or no?
Yeah. I mean, their size is they're so big and they're in so many jurisdictions. I think it's hard to quantify that. But I think in general, you know, diversion rates aren't really where they want to be. You know, it's really regulatory driven, you know, at the state level and then at the local jurisdictional level. But it also is asset based, you know, so much of that business, whether it's WM or otherwise, is based on availability of assets and where you can actually move the material to, you know.
Right, right. There's some real, there's a lot of reality there in so much
there's
resistance.
A lot of reality there.
So much resistance to landfilling. So how many years were you there and did you feel good about your role there?
Yeah. No, it was a really great time. Amazing team of people. I was there about 7 years. So I joined in 2011 and I left in 2018. And that's when I started consulting with some climate tech companies.
Well, let's talk about some of them. And I know that, you know, some end up really well and some don't. I think Blue Box, you would say you never really felt the love at the end of the day, but talk about Blue Box. This sort of gets to your theme of entrepreneurialism and working with sustainability products and working with really innovative products. Blue Box was this kind of, I don't know, magical treatment of HVAC filters that would clean them in an environmentally sustainable way and cause all sorts of energy savings.
The main focus was the actual heat transfer coils, you know, of the HVAC system. There were some experimentation with filters as well, and there actually was a pretty good performance on that. So who knows, maybe that's something that'll be picked back up at a later date. But at the time, you know, they were experimenting with all kinds of cleaning applications. And I worked and supported them for a long time as an advisor for a time, and then really as a paid consultant for a time to really do a couple of things, to obviously expand market share and bring them to market, but also to sort of prove the sustainability metrics and the impact that it could have. You know, energy efficiency is one of them. It's the biggest one. And so, you know, there were several, you know, exercises that went through from like a measurement and verification standpoint, working with different utilities and different markets and places around the country to actually prove some of the assumptions that were made by creating efficiency around this process. And it is an incredible process, and Blue Box is still, you know, going. I'm no longer affiliated with them, but they are still, you know, in the marketplace, and to my knowledge, you know, really the only solution that takes this type of approach of really improving the efficiency of equipment that, you know, it's just like, you know, you buy a car, right? And you drive, the minute you drive a new car off the lot, it loses a certain amount of its value and useful life. An air conditioning unit at the commercial level, really at the residential level too, is no different. And unless you have certain kind of really good maintenance and, you know, you do certain things to it, it just loses its efficiency over time. And so, you know, Blue Box really created an incredible innovation on how to sort of extend that useful life of the equipment while at the same time really restoring sort of the efficiency to maybe not its new state, but, you know, relatively close to that. So that was it was a really fun project to work on.
Yeah, I'm glad you reeled me in there. I clarified it wasn't the filters, it was the coils, and the coils are often just neglected, right? I mean, there's just no,
definitely,
there's no simple way of cleaning a commercial building's coils without shutting everything down and spraying around all sorts of toxic chemicals, and it's a mess.
Yeah, it's kind of a design problem. You know, it's the way that they're designed to function and to do the job that they're doing is also it lends itself to not really a high level of cleanability. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
Just the nature of the design of those HVAC systems are really difficult to clean.
And Blue Box was magical in that it was, I mean, literally you guys were delivering a suitcase sized piece of equipment that technicians would use to spray into the coils. And I, as I understand it, you could leave the building, the system could be running, it was non-toxic, and it would do this remarkable job of cleaning up the coils.
Yeah, it is. And it really applies to almost any building type. You know, there are some buildings that, you know, lend themselves more to the fouling of the coils. So like think hospitals and hotels, things that are really high traffic, you know, type buildings. Those types of systems can get dirty faster, you know, but yeah, it's a pretty universal solution.
And he proved the concept with some casinos in Vegas, I think. And
Exactly.
Really remarkable. And
that was part of, exactly. So when I came on board with sort of my environmental background, it was sort of like, how do we look at proving, you know, some of those numbers, so they are validated in the marketplace, because, you know, it became an important part of a return on investment from the customer perspective.
And when the market is that broad, that wide open, I remember having a few discussions with you and your colleagues there, that which direction do you go in? Do you try to support utility programs, or do you try to go to chain stores, or do you go to only casinos or hospitals? Or it's just, the market is so large.
To kind of come full circle on that, that's sort of the conundrum of many founders that have different technologies in climate tech, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when I left WM, I was working with several companies in different areas, and they all had their different sets of challenges. And, you know, when you do have a good technology, whether it's, you know, applicable to buildings, or if it's applicable in mobility or what have you, mm-hmm. That ends up being sort of a little bit of the conundrum, right? Is how do you narrow down the focus, and how do you, you know, sort of land where you need to land, you know, for survival in a lot of ways.
Right. And then scalability, ideally. Sure.
And then scalability. Yeah, for sure.
Let's talk. Was it Let's Hitch, or just Hitch?
Just Hitch. Hitch Rewards is, I think, what it was originally referred to, but just Hitch. And that's that mobility app that's a mm-hmm. group based out of Nashville.
And what was your role with that?
Same thing. I was just sort of helping with some business development. They had gotten some really good traction down in Nashville with some pilot projects in the cities down there and some municipalities. And I met the founder, a gentleman named Mark Cleveland, great guy, also a serial entrepreneur. And I had met him at a conference, and I listened to him give a presentation, and I thought it was really compelling. And so we kept in touch. And when I left Waste Management, he got in touch and said, you know, hey, you know, can you potentially get on board and help me out and maybe pursue some opportunities in your neck of the woods, which is, you know, the West Coast. So, you know, we did. I brought in some partners, and we activated some opportunities in Southern California and then in the Bay Area. And so, yeah, it was primarily a business development and kind of an advisory role.
And what was its unique selling proposition, or what was its basic business model? Was it much like Uber and Lyft?
Yeah, I mean, it's a carpooling app, you know, and obviously the timing of the pandemic didn't, you know, help any carpooling technology, right? Because in the early days of COVID, no one really knew, you know, safety. It was a safety concern about transmission and things like that. But at its core, what's interesting about Hitch was that it was sort of creating an environment where both drivers and riders were being paid. So traditional ride sharing or carpooling, it usually pays a driver, right? So the idea around Hitch was that you could incentivize both drivers and passengers. And the idea is that it would, you know, at least one of them is it would help create the momentum, you know, around you know, usability and create more volumes of riders and drivers that would get into the platform. And it was set up in a similar way that you would have sponsors or employers or municipalities mm-hmm. that would look at certain corridors or certain times of day. They were also working with universities, you know, around parking situations. So it was like, it was sort of creating incentives and behavior change. And some of their secret sauce was around their ability to to, you know, pinpoint and narrow down certain problem areas and incentivize based on where you wanted to go. So if you wanted to incentivize people to park in a certain parking structure and ride a shuttle to where they need to go, you know, you could do that and do all kinds of things around technology and geofencing and stuff like that. Wow. So it was a really unique technology and a really dynamic team.
Next one, Ocean Works. You're pulling plastics out of the ocean. What was your role with this company?
Yeah. Another you know, really interesting sort of young entrepreneur that I was introduced to, a guy named Rob Iannelli. And I'm trying to remember exactly how we were originally introduced. I'm not even sure I remember, but anyway, we were introduced through a mutual friend, I think, or something. And also a really compelling value proposition. And I worked with those guys for about a year to sort of do some market intelligence around, you know, whether or not there was demand for this material. So the Ocean Works's ultimate sort of goal was to create an online marketplace for this material. And if they could match buyers with sellers and buyers with producers and buyers with supply chain, that could bring the price down and actually make it a lot easier for people that are making stuff, you know, whether it was apparel or any kind of product or widget that uses a typical plastic, that they could have a viable, you know, cost-effective recycled solution from an ocean or ocean-bound plastic. And so we did basically a roadshow for a series of months with apparel companies, CPG companies, et cetera, just to see, you know, hey, this is what we're working on. And if we were to get it to, you know, to this place, would that be something that you'd be interested in investing in as a buyer of this material? And, you know, really the response was overwhelming. It was just absolutely yes. And it's something that people needed. So yeah, so I helped them, you know, kind of on a BD and sort of due diligence, you know, roadshow.
They were literally pulling plastics out of the ocean, or plastic, like you said, ocean-bound plastic. They were pulling plastics that would end up in the ocean, and then selling that material to companies that would tout it as ocean recovered. Or that's great. And is that company going well
absolutely.
Now?
Absolutely. They were working with collection groups and processors and people like the manufacturers in different parts of the world to trace, you know, the material to make sure that it's actually legitimate and get it processed into actual, you know, pellets, yarns, things like that. So if you're a t-shirt manufacturer, you know, you could buy this yarn and you know it would be certified and you know it would be, you know, the quality that you need in order to make your product. So they were trying to create this marketplace, you know, so people could buy high quality product and really, you know, look at, you know, a certain amount of recyclability in their product.
And is that company going well?
Yeah. The marketplace is live. It's been live for a few years, and I think they're growing every year. I think they're doing well.
That's awesome. Well, let's just wrap up with talking about your role with Sustainable Surf. You've been a board member. How is Sustainable Surf sustainable? What do you guys do?
Yeah, so I met one of the founders of Sustainable Surf at, of all places, a global reporting initiative, a GRI training class. And we were sitting across the table from each other and everyone was making introductions. And he said, "My name is Kevin and I'm from Manhattan Beach." And I thought, "Oh, that's interesting." And so at lunch, I walked over and I said, "Hey, you know, I'm from Manhattan Beach too." And we started talking and he told me what they were working on. And this is in the very, very early stages of what Sustainable Surf was doing. And they've done so much since then. It's been over 10 years now that I've been working with them as either an advisor or in the last few years as a board member. But their mission really was to use the sport of surfing and to, you know, really to sort of influence and the community that surfing represents, right? Which is health, wellness, you know, nature and all these kinds of things. To not only help the surf industry itself become more sustainable by, you know, changing the way surfboards are constructed and using better materials, to changing the way the events are run, to, you know, influencing, you know, how the products, the apparel, the accessories, all those things are made by doing life cycle assessments and consulting and things like that, doing all that great stuff. But also just kind of leveraging the community itself to be like, hey, we can be a force for good. And so I originally got involved with them because when I was at Waste Management, is when I met them. They had this program called Waste of Waves, where they were collecting EPS foam, you know, like the packing foam that you get when you buy a TV and stuff like that. Thankfully, there's less of that now, but back in the day, it used to be a lot. And they would compact that and recycle it, and they'd turn that into the material that you would make new surfboards out of. And so I actually got Waste Management to be a sponsor of one of their big events. And so that was how my first entry point into working with the two founders, Kevin Wilden and Michael Stewart, really great guys. And so, yeah, that was the beginning. And then, so it just sort of iterated over time. And, you know, now they're doing some incredible stuff around biodiversity and coastal restoration programs and with coral reefs and kelp beds and carbon sequestration. And I mean, it's really cutting edge stuff that they're doing. But it's been a really rewarding experience. Yeah.
That is fantastic. Oh, good for you. Gosh, good for us. There's just so many groups that are doing such good and so many people like yourselves that are driving these initiatives and advising initiatives like this. Fantastic. Hey, Brian, thanks for being on the podcast. We'll do it again.
Anytime.
All right. Talk to you later. That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.